Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Tomorrow marks 3 months since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. Approximately 2 million Americans infected since then, more than 100,000 dead. States and cities have continued the reopening process as mass protests against police brutality in response to George Floyd's death have added an extra layer of complexity for public health as physical distancing may clash with the cause of social justice. So this hour on Point, we'll talk with a leading public health official about the latest on the coronavirus pandemic. And Dr. Ashish Jha joins us today from Cambridge, Massachusetts. He's a professor of global health at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and director of the Harvard Global Health Institute. He's also a practicing internist and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Jha, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Meghna.
So first of all, just give us kind of a big picture assessment as to where the United States is on the coronavirus curve. When we talked to you 3 months ago, I think I've lost track of time, to be perfectly honest. We were talking about flattening the curve back then. Where are we now?
Yeah. So, you know, the good news is we have flattened the curve in the sense that we no longer are rising exponentially. We have a sort of a steady stream of about 20,000 cases a day that we're identifying. About 1,000 Americans a day, between 800 and 1,000 Americans a day, are dying from this virus. The goal, I mean, flattening is one goal that we really should have done is brought the curve way down. There is no reason we need to be in a situation where 1,000 Americans are dying every day. And yet that's where we are, and that's where we've opened. And every projection says that's likely where we're going to stay throughout the entire summer, adding another 30,000 deaths a month for the next 3 months.
So that's not bending the curve downward at all. That's a plateau of consistent infection and mortality.
Absolutely. Yeah, though this is not a victory. This is, we avoided the kind of catastrophic exponential curve where we kept adding more and more cases every day, and we've brought it. But think of it as we kind of went up a mountain and now we've hit a plateau. We have not come down from that mountain. And underneath that mountain is a lot of suffering, a lot of people getting sick, and a lot of people dying every day.
Okay, so that is very different than what has happened in a couple of other countries, right, that have really bent that curve downward. I mean, people frequently look to New Zealand, Iceland, for example. I mean, smaller nations, island nations, I get it. But in order for us to beat the pandemic here, ideally we want to see a reduction in the daily number of infections and deaths.
Yeah, so there are incredible success stories like New Zealand and like Iceland and like South Korea. But even countries that did a bad job initially, like Italy, which really kind of had a catastrophic response initially, eventually got their act together. And they really brought their cases and their deaths way, way down. We opened up at a time, I mean, there were two parts of it. We never really fully shut down, right? There were parts of the country that remained open throughout all of March and April and May. And then we started opening up at a point where we still had quite a few cases. And if we had been more aggressive in our shutdown, we could have opened up with far fewer daily cases. It would have bought us a lot more freedom to get back to life and be able to do a lot of things and not have to deal with 1,000 not deal with, but not have to suffer 1,000 deaths every day. We just didn't. We just weren't aggressive about this.
So we just didn't. And at the same time, right now, of course, over the past several weeks, we've had states beginning their reopening process. So yeah. Was that premature?
You know, it's hard to answer in the following way. People really were antsy to get back. And, you know, as I was talking to folks, and including members of my family, people wanted to start kind of getting some semblance of their lives back. And I think of it in two ways. One is I think we were not aggressive enough when we did shut down. And many states were. Massachusetts did a good job, but not every place. But the second is we didn't use that time to really build up our testing and tracing and isolation infrastructure. Because the other way to bring the caseload down, one is to shut down. But the other is to build up a fabulous testing, tracing, and isolation infrastructure. We just didn't. And so if we had spent March and April doing that, we could have opened up at the time that we have and not have as many cases as we do.
Mm. Okay, so let's talk about the testing part of that, because, of course, yep. for many months, as you just noted, that has been such an issue. Were there enough tests, or were they in the right places? Who was getting tested, et cetera? Just yep. So for testing specifically, where are we now?
Yeah, so we're better than where we were a couple of months ago, but far from where we need to be. And so, you know, right now we're doing about 400,000 tests a day. Seems like a lot. Just remember, we're a country of 330 million people. So, at that rate, it would take about 3 years to test everybody. So, obviously, not anywhere near where we want to be. And when we think about what we want to do with our testing, the entire purpose of testing is to identify people who are infected and isolate them so they don't infect other people. And then, of course, take care of them because they're infected and might be sick. So that requires a strategy for testing that probably requires, 3 to 5 million tests a day if we're going to do that effectively. There are people like Paul Romer, who's a Nobel laureate in economics, who has argued for 30 million tests a day, testing every American every 10 days. You know, that'd be great, but I feel like even if we could get to 3 to 5 million tests a day, that would be really, really helpful in both reducing the number of deaths we have in America and letting us open up our economy more. But we just haven't done it.
Well, I suppose a lot of people are wondering if they, even if they're asymptomatic right now, should they seek a coronavirus test in terms of, to help them decide sort of how they're going to live their lives over the next couple of weeks or months?
Yeah, so for me right now, the priority is we've got to be testing. Certainly, we should be testing everybody who has even mild symptoms. We should be testing contacts of those people who test positive. And then we should be deploying a lot of tests towards high-risk places. We should have a very aggressive testing strategy for hospitals, for nursing homes, for factories. Those are where the big outbreaks have been. So if you're a pretty healthy person, not working in one of those contacts, has no symptoms, you could go get a test. But I don't know that there would be a ton of utility, especially given that we still don't have as much testing as we need. For me, it's really about deploying it in a way that both identifies high-risk places and high-risk people so we can bring the level of virus down in our community.
Okay. So let's get right to an additional layer of complexity here, which is, when you're talking about high-risk places, we have seen unprecedented mass protests over a number of weeks across the country now. Do we yet know, has enough time passed to understand whether that could lead to another spike in infections?
Yeah, so as you might imagine, those of us who have been in public health for a long time have been worried about a couple of different things. Obviously, there's a long history of systemic racism in our country, and that has very deleterious public health effects. And in that light, I have been very supportive of the protests and the protesters. But at the same time, I've been worried, I think all of us have, that the protests will lead to more cases. And so far, I think we are seeing increases in cases in large parts of the country, but those are almost surely from the opening up around Memorial Day. I think it's too early to see the impact of the protests on the number of cases. And what we're seeing is in many, many states, probably between a half a dozen and a dozen states, really sharp increases in the number of cases. And those sharp increases began about a week ago, probably reflecting the opening up of the economy. And over the next couple of weeks, we will start seeing how much of an impact the protests are going to have. I believe that protests are going to have an impact. I don't think they're going to be very large. And I'm happy to kind of walk you through why. But at the end of the day, I think the protests are going to probably fuel a few more cases. And we should try to do everything we can to mitigate that.
Okay, so walk us through why you don't think the impact's going to be very large.
Yeah, so it's worth remembering that, you know, even the most optimistic assessments of how many protesters there are have been, you know, maybe 500,000, maybe a million people have protested. That's about a quarter to half a percent of the entire population protesting. So, you know, it's very different than when, let's say, Massachusetts opens up its economy and people go back to retail stores and grocery stores and all of that. There, 30, 40, 50% of the people are engaging in those activities. A very tiny sliver of the population is engaging in protests. Second,
but can I just jump in here, though?
So that's
a population level analysis. But I mean, we've had in certain places. Boston, as you well know, that like the pandemic was really accelerated by super spreader events. Why couldn't we have that in the case where there's tens or hundreds of thousands of people in close proximity on the streets of various American cities?
Absolutely. We can. And that's why I said I am worried about this. And I don't mean to minimize that risk. I think there are a couple of other things that make me feel a little bit better. And I think things that we could be doing. So one is, over the last month, I think we've seen more and more evidence that being outside is actually pretty helpful. And so gatherings outside are better. When we think about the super spreader events that happened in Boston, I think most of them were inside, and most of the super, not all, but most of the super spreader events have happened inside. Second is, it's really critical for protesters to be wearing masks. And we do think masks help a lot in reducing spread of the disease. And so the combination of those two things, I think, should help. But I am not minimizing the fact that these protests may very well set off more cases.
Okay. But actually, quite frankly, Dr. Zha, it's very heartening to hear that you think that it might be more cases, but not a terrible avalanche of more, right? Is that what I hear you saying?
That is what I'm saying. I think we just, there has been this question of our public health people minimizing the risk, and I'm not. But I, as I look at it and I think about the proportion of people protesting versus, it's a pretty small proportion. They're doing it outside and most of them are wearing masks. And all of that makes me think it might cause some outbreak, but it's not going to be an avalanche.
Okay. So we are talking this hour about where we are as a nation in fighting the coronavirus pandemic, the latest in what we know. We've got a lot more to talk about when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with one of the nation's leading public health experts about where we are as a country and even as a world regarding our latest understanding of the novel coronavirus and fighting the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Ashish Jha joins us today. He is director of the Harvard Global Health Institute, and we'll be hearing from another public health expert in just a moment. But Dr. Jha, I just want to I want to ask a little bit more about the complexity of seeing these mass protests in the midst of a pandemic. I think it's pretty safe to say that we've never experienced anything like this, at least not in our lifetimes, right? Not in a century of seeing the last time we had a mass protest and a pandemic was, I think, in Philadelphia in 1918. And that was a parade, not a protest, just fact-checking myself. But the point is, though, is when we think about what public health is, writ large, or the public's health, you can understand the deep desire that people have to say, well, the health of many, many Americans relies on combating these structural inequities, and that this is a moment in which to fully push back against those equities, pandemic be damned.
Yeah, I don't even know if it's pandemic be damned. You know, it's interesting in that we have gone through an extraordinary 4 or 5 months as a country. And there are a couple of things I think worth understanding. One is the pandemic has really disproportionately hit the African-American community very, very hard. Mm-hmm. The number of cases, the number of deaths has been disproportionately high. And so I think there are a lot of folks in the African-American community who are feeling very battered by the pandemic. And then the George Floyd video, I mean, I think it broke a dam in a way. It set forth forces that have been building up for a while. I think we've seen for a very long time the effects of systemic racism on people in America, on Black people in America, just to be very specific. And what I think that video did, and at least I'll speak for myself, I watched it once and I just couldn't bear to watch it again. The impunity with which that police officer felt that he could kill a Black person, I think it sort of shocked people in a way that you could argue people shouldn't have been shocked, because we've known about this level of racism and police brutality for a long time. And it has really, I think, set off a movement that is fueled by the frustration and anger people feel about the way that the COVID pandemic has hit certain communities more than others. And it has unleashed a force that I hope will do real good in moving the country forward in our long struggle against racism. Go ahead.
No, please finish your thought. Go ahead.
No, so I was going to say, in that context, you know, there have been people who say, well, why aren't public health people speaking out against these protests? And I feel like there is a nuance and subtlety here around the broader context of how we improve the health of the people of the United States. And ignoring all of that pent up energy and anger and telling people just stay at home and don't protest. First of all, I think I don't think people are going to listen. Second, I think it misses what people are feeling right now. And so I've thought a lot about how do we help people express those sentiments, but try to minimize the risks of doing so through mask wearing and all the other things we've been talking about.
Okay, so we'll come back to that in more detail in a moment. But Dr. Jha, I wonder if you could stand by for a moment, because I'd like to now bring into the conversation Dr. Uthibe Essien. He joins us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. His focus is on racial and ethnic health disparities in America. Dr. Essien, welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Meghna.
So pick up where Dr. Jha left off about, I mean, how that health and public health, especially for African Americans in this country, is this like multifactorial thing, and pushing back against racism is a big part of that at the same time that we're fighting the pandemic. What are you thinking about on those issues right now?
Right. I think Dr. Jha offering us the advice to take a step back and bring context into this picture is hugely important. I think the idea that a second wave of COVID-19 infections are coming from protests is not quite right when we think about the death of George Floyd that spurned those protests. We think about the sadness, the anger, the frustration that came about when we saw the death of Ahmaud Arbery even before that. And again, just the centuries of discrimination, racism, and violence towards Black Americans in our country that has really led up to this moment where Black Americans, whether we're in the public health field, physician, scientist, or an essential worker, is having to make this perverse choice of staying safe at home or going out and fighting for our lives.
Mm. And so in that fight for lives portion, I mean, people are so compelled to go out into the streets to engage in that fight. What are you counseling folks to do who are protesting in order to minimize the risks that they might face as they go out into the streets?
Yeah, so Dr. Jha mentioned this as well, but making sure that the same advice that we've been giving our patients, our communities over the last few months, whether it's related to wearing masks that cover your mouth and your nose, really important during this time, especially in bigger crowds, to ensure that you're wearing eyewear as well. We continue to advise folks to maintain a safe distance of 6 feet, which, as we've seen in some of the photos, is quite challenging right now. But I think those points of advice are still clear and obvious. Taking a step back, but also ensuring that when folks have gone out to protest, that they make sure they're not sick. We would advise, I think, that anyone who has any symptoms stay at home if they can. And I think many of us are also advising that folks consider self-quarantining at home after they return from protesting, which we, of course, know is a privilege and much easier said than done. But so those are some of the advice I think we're giving right now.
I just want to ask both of you also what you think of speaking of the perversions that in the early days of the protests in some places where protesters were getting tear gassed. Right. That caused a lot of respiratory distress, coughing, et cetera, in the midst of these big crowds. There's so many issues with that. But I just wanted to, like, Dr. Jha, what did you think about that? Because that made an already bad situation worse from even just the perspective of health.
Yeah. You know, so the way I've thought about this is we are in the middle of the biggest pandemic in a century, the worst economic depression in a century, and civil unrest as a response to centuries of oppression. And in the middle of that, we have a response from our government, and this being very explicit, our federal government, and particularly our president, who's been pouring fuel on this fire. And it has led to clashes that have caused, you know, much more suffering than they need to. Imagine a president who could have used this moment to bring us together, to allow for peaceful protests without tear gas, without making things worse. It wouldn't have solved everything, but it would have made this moment, this incredibly difficult moment, easier. I think we all have to acknowledge that the leadership here has really made things worse. Tear gas is just one element of that broader situation.
Dr. Essien, go ahead.
I think that's exactly right. The coughing and sneezing that, Megna, you're referring to, the need to maybe take the glasses or goggles that you're wearing off to help manage the irritation from those inhalants, and certainly can make one at higher risk, rather, of exposure to the virus. So I think that that's important to think about. One of my colleagues offered the perspective that back in 1968, a year that we often bring up during this time, it wasn't tear gas or rubber bullets. It was water cannons and dogs that individuals who are out there protesting were facing. And thinking about the health profession and how we have to respond to whatever that response looks like to protesting is really quite interesting and something that I know that many of us as providers are really thinking about in this moment.
Yeah. So, Dr. Jha, let me ask you one more question specifically about the protests and what they say about pandemic control. I'm still thinking about your sort of your tempered optimism, your cautious optimism that you expressed a couple of minutes ago. What would you say to people who then say, well, shouldn't we be allowing more large groups outdoors anyway, if we can be cautiously optimistic about disease transmission in these mass protests for as long as people continue to follow the same advice that you're giving right now?
Well, so what I've said is I've been very clear. I don't think the protests are going to have no cost in terms of number of cases. And so what I have advised is things that are not essential. And, you know, I'm going to be very honest. I think pool parties are not essential. But so therefore, I'm, you know, pretty much against doing things that are not essential that will fuel cases. I don't see protests as non-essential. And people do have to weigh those risks and benefits. And you're not always only weighing the risk for yourself, also for your families and your community. So I don't think there's a moral equivalence for all activities that happen outdoors. And I think we have to be thoughtful about how we make these trade-offs.
Yeah. And Dr. Essien, did you want to add your thoughts to that?
I think that's exactly right. And making sure that our communities continue to receive the necessary information. There continues to be journalists and public health officials putting out important information about this crisis, whether it's how to protest safely, whether it's how to go to your primary care doctor safely in this moment. So ensuring that we do allow our communities to receive this critical information and make sure the voices that share that information are trusted by our communities, I think, is just as important as us having this conversation now.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have received already a lot of questions about the pandemic from listeners that have submitted them online. So On Point producer Dori Scheimer is here to walk us through a bunch of those questions. Dori, what do you got?
Yeah, let's just start with the WHO. We got a lot of questions about their communication. And the first question, you know, just generally, why has the WHO been giving conflicting information? So this Rekha asks us, you know, first there was no need to wear mask, then a mask, then lots of asymptomatic carriers, then very rare, and now they're walking that back. She says it undermines people's trust and willingness to follow their recommendations.
Okay, so Dr. Jha, let me just refine Rekha's question here a little bit, because in the past couple of days there was that WHO study, I guess, or reference to the fact that we should be less worried about asymptomatic transmission than we thought before. What should we actually know about that?
Yeah. So this was just a communication flub. The person misspoke. Look, we know that asymptomatic transmission is a major source of infection spread. I don't think there's any question in my mind. I don't think there's any question in the minds of other experts. What the WHO official was speaking about was a very technical, small subgroup of asymptomatic people, people who never develop symptoms, who are identified through contact tracing. And was making a point about that, but did it in a way that, you know, just was inelegant. And I'm not trying to be critical of her. There's a lot that goes on in daily press conferences. And I think it kind of blew up and they had to walk it back because it was necessary to walk it back. The evidence is still pretty clear. Asymptomatic people spread the disease. And that's why we have to wear masks. That's why you have to do social distancing, even if you feel well.
Okay.
Yeah, we've got another question from KJ. She's worried about her grandson going back to daycare, and she wants to know, you know, what public health experts are what advice you're giving about people sending their kids back to daycare as more and more of the country is reopening and people are going back to work.
Dr. Essien, let me turn that to you, because I think there are literally millions of people who are wondering about whether they should be sending their kids back to school.
Right. So we know that most schools remain closed. And so for school age kids, whether that's from kindergarten through to high school, I believe folks for the most part are staying home right now. For the younger kids, that is the challenge, right? Our economy is opening and we are asking our workforce to figure out how to now Zoom daycare their children and have to go to work at the same time. So I think that is a really important question. I know the pediatricians are not recommending masks for students and children of certain ages. I believe it's up to 2 years of age, because of how difficult it is for them to maintain that mask. So I think if parents are bringing their children back to daycares, thinking about what their daycare setup is right now, how they're going to manage this idea of social distancing, are the workers in the daycare being tested or at least asked about symptoms and making sure that they can stay home. It's really quite challenging. And again, I think that is one of the big questions that need to be asked as we're reopening our economy, is how will our children manage, especially the parents who have to go to work and take care of those kids.
So Dr. Essien, let me just push this a little bit more, because I think schools are one of those places in which we see the health impacts of structural inequities, right? Because we've already got, you know, in places across the country, certain communities, they have older school buildings, leaded pipes, old HVAC systems, perhaps not as well funded to begin with, larger student to teacher ratios. All of that's already there, even prior to the pandemic. And as cities and states consider about how to reopen schools, I'm seeing that there may be places in which students are expected to bring their own masks, et cetera. And maybe families, you know, can't arrange to have a freshly laundered mask for their kids all the time. I mean, I feel like this is a perfect example of how these inequities just perpetuate bad health outcomes.
That's exactly right, Meghna. And thinking about who was able to, over the last 3 months, continue their education through broadband internet, we heard anecdotal stories of students sitting in a McDonald's parking lot to be able to take their AP exams in the past spring. And so that's such a challenge. We know how closely, as public health researchers, education is linked to health outcomes down the future. So even thinking far beyond this current or acute post-COVID-19 era, we really do need to think about the future, the children in 10 to 20 years who are now not experiencing the same education rate that they might be experiencing. I think your point around just the physical space in the schools as well is really critical. We know that those schools also are placed in neighborhoods that have higher rates of pollution. We know how closely pollution is linked to asthma and how closely asthma is linked to severe COVID-19 infection. So we always, I think, need to put all of these conversations in that context. And while those of us on the front lines taking care of patient X in front of us might not be able to fix the pollution in our patients' communities, working with our public health officials and policymakers to address those issues is really critical right now.
Well, Dr. Uthibe Essien is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Joined us today from Pittsburgh. Dr. Essien, it was great to have you back on the show. Thank you so very much.
Thanks so much, Meghna.
And Dr. Jha, stand by for just a minute because we do have a slew of more questions from our listeners for you. So we'll get to them when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be hearing from members of the high school class of 2020 and what they're thinking and feeling and wondering about their own lives as they enter into adulthood in the midst of nationwide protests about over inequality and the pandemic as well. So if you're a high school member of the class of 2020, call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And tell us the story about what your plans are for the next steps in your life. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are checking back in with Dr. Ashish Jha. He is director of the Harvard Global Health Institute, a leading public health expert in this country, about where we are in terms of our understanding of the novel coronavirus and the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. And Dr. Jha, as I said, we've got lots more listener questions. So Dori, give us a couple more here.
John asked us on Twitter, does the change over to summer impact the virus like it does the flu and other coronavirus? So are there going to be different strains at the end of the summer?
So not worried about a different strain. This is a different virus than the influenza virus. So I think we have one strain of this virus, and I don't think that there's any reason to believe that's going to change a lot over time. In terms of the summer, we have all wondered how much of a seasonal effect are we going to get. We do think the virus transmits a little bit less well in warm weather, in more humid weather. Seasonality might be helpful for us in the summer, but it's a double-edged sword because what it gives us in the summer in terms of a bit more freedom, it takes away in the fall and winter when we're all spending more time indoors and the weather gets cooler. So we'll see. I think we'll have some seasonal effects from the virus.
Nature giveth and taketh away. But Dr. Jha, let me just get some clarification for you on something. You said there's one strain of SARS-CoV-2?
Yes. So look, viruses mutate all the time. Like literally every, there are minor mutations. So the question is what really constitutes a different strain? And And ultimately, it's about the issue of, is it functionally different? Is it spread, you know, does a new mutation mean the virus spreads faster, or is it more lethal or less susceptible to a vaccine? And when I speak to virologists and when I ask virologists, how many strains are there? Pretty much all of them say it's one. Lots of variations on that strain, but one functional strain of the virus.
Okay. Very
as of right now.
Variations, yeah, but one functional strain. Okay. As for now. Okay. Look, our knowledge is changing on a day-to-day basis, so point well taken. Dori, more questions, please.
Yes, Alicia asked us, is it possible that people are carrying the virus for longer than 14 days before they start experiencing symptoms?
This is a very good question. Most of the data on this suggests that people develop symptoms around day 5 to 7. There have been a few cases of people who might have, had the virus for longer than that. 14 days, in my mind, starts getting kind of far out. It's not impossible, but pretty unlikely.
So let me ask you, I'm just jumping the queue here, Dori, a little bit, because one thing that I want to know about is where we are, Dr. Jha, on the search for a vaccine.
Yeah, so this is one where I'm pretty optimistic. We have probably about 10 plus vaccines in clinical trials, another 70, 80 candidate vaccines that people are working on developing. And we have a couple in phase two, and I suspect that by the end of the summer, we'll have a much better sense of how many vaccines are likely to end up being effective. We'll run larger trials in the fall. And if everything goes really well, I could see a vaccine getting approved in early 2021 and becoming widely available, let's say, you know, April, May, June of 2021. That's a pretty optimistic scenario. Could that get derailed? It could. But if things go well, that's what we're looking at.
That would be remarkable, right? I think that would be historic, the fastest vaccine development we've ever seen.
By far. Usually these things take 3 to 5 years. And one of the key issues is going to be, because we're all so desperate for a vaccine, there's going to be a temptation to cut corners. And I think it's really important not just to make sure these vaccines are effective, but that they are safe. And the best way to know that is to really do the clinical trials that are necessary to ensure that these vaccines really are safe.
So can you tell me a little bit more about that? Because I think a lot of people do have concerns. If the speed at which the development is going is so fast, is there enough time? Or will the clinical trials span a long enough period of time to be sure of safety and efficacy, for that matter?
Right. And so there are a couple of different issues. You know, one of the reasons it takes so long is because we do each step and then we go to the next step and we're very careful. One of the things we've been doing in this development is we're doing multiple things at once. We did animal trials at the same time that we were doing human trials. So that's not really cutting corners. That's because we still get data from both. So that, in my mind, gives me assurance. The big issue is going to be the size of the clinical trials and whether we're going to really test these vaccines out in enough people in phase three. And I want to make sure we don't cut those corners, because ultimately we want to get to a point where tens of thousands of people have gotten the vaccine. It's been shown safe in those. Doesn't mean we might not miss a 1 in a million bad reaction. But as long as we've tested it in tens of thousands of people, I think we're going to feel comfortable giving it out more broadly. I'm going to feel comfortable my kids getting it. But we really need to see that data, and we need to see those people, enough people having gotten the vaccine and what the safety profile is for them.
Okay, but that will take time then.
It will. That's why it's going to take us many, many months. That's why people who somehow think we're going to have a vaccine by September or October, no. Just there isn't enough time to, you know, test it in enough people. And you also want to make sure you're testing it in older people. You want to test it in young folks. And the issue is, if you just test it in, you know, 30-year-old healthy people, you won't know what the effects will be when you give it to the 70-year-old person or the 15-year-old child. So we really want to test it in a broad range of people as well.
Now, are we looking at a vaccine that may confer permanent immunity to the SARS-CoV-2, or might it be more like getting an annual flu shot?
Yeah, so we don't know. We don't know a lot about this virus. We don't even know if having recovered from the virus gives you lifelong immunity. And I think many people think it doesn't. And so if recovery from the infection doesn't give you lifelong immunity, it's hard to come up with a vaccine that's going to give you lifelong immunity. I would not be surprised if this is the kind of vaccine that we have to get every year as a way to refresh our immunity. But as far as I'm concerned, that'd be fine. I mean, I get my flu shot every year. If I have to get a coronavirus vaccine on top of that, that would be fine, as long as it confers enough immunity that people don't get very sick when they get the virus.
Tori, I think I stole one of the listeners' questions here.
Yes, but a lot of people wanted to know about immunity. And with the antibody tests, if that gives you how long that gives you immunity if you take the test and it shows that you do have the antibodies.
Yeah. So where we are on antibody testing, again, there are literally dozens of antibody tests out there. A vast majority of them are of poor quality and generate a lot of false positives. So if you're getting an antibody test, you got to make sure you're getting one of the ones with a very, very, very high specificity. You can look up things on the FDA website. And I think more and more good places are turning to these tests. If you get one of those high quality tests and you're positive, it should confer immunity, but we don't know exactly. And then we have no idea how long this is going to last because this virus has only been, well, we've only been aware of this virus for about 6 months. I think it is safe to say right now that you're unlikely to have lifelong immunity, but we don't know that for sure. And I'm guessing that most people are going to have immunity for 12 to 18 months. But that may be good enough. It gets us to the vaccine.
I think it's safe to say it for safety, it's better to presume higher risk rather than the low risk outcome. But exactly. but Dr. Jha, for people who don't know what specificity means, what does that mean, and what kind of number would you, if people are going to the FDA website, what kind of number should they be looking for specificity?
Yeah, sorry about the little lingo use there. For every test, there is a characteristic of, you know, if somebody is positive and gets that test, what's the likelihood that that test will turn positive for somebody with the infection or antibodies? That's the sensitivity. And a specificity is if you don't have antibodies, in reality, what are the chances that the test will identify you correctly as not having the antibodies? That's the specificity. For this test, for the populations and the level of infection we have in the community right now, you need a specificity well over at least 99%, if not over 99%. Otherwise, you're going to start getting a lot of false positives. So if a test has a 90% specificity, sounds really good, it's completely inadequate. And that's why it's really important for people to know which tests they're getting.
Are there tests out, antibody tests with 99% specificity out there? I hadn't heard of that high.
Yeah, there are a couple that have been going through FDA approval. They might have gone through FDA approval already. So we are starting to get a couple of high-quality antibody tests that allow for us to do that.
Okay. But then, of course, given the American healthcare system, the availability of the test and whether or not people's insurance covers it is always going to be part of that story, too. But, Dori, do we have more questions here?
We've got one more from Amy. She's asking, you know, this goes back to our daycare question, that people are now being called back to work as more places reopen. And she's asking, should an older person with or without underlying health issues worry about going back to work? It feels as though we haven't had much concrete data. If it's safe to get on public transit or work in an office with other people, share a kitchen, bathroom spaces, things like that.
Yeah, so this is a difficult situation because obviously people are trying to figure out how much of their lives can they get back and how quickly. And, you know, I talked to my elderly parents who have been essentially locked up at home for the last 3 months, and they're asking, when can we see our friends? When can we go to the grocery store? When can we do these things? And there are a few things that I use in my head to sort of give advice. One is you got to look at the amount of disease in your community. If you're in a community with a lot of disease burden, it's much higher risk. If you do go out, you have to really do what you can to protect yourself and people around you. So definitely wearing a mask. If you're in a office space where you're really crammed up against other people, that's not particularly safe. And those offices really should be creating social distancing within the workplace. And I think things like cafeterias in office places would bring large numbers of people together. Those are probably bad ideas. And people should not be congregating, especially indoors, because indoors is much higher risk. So there's no single piece of advice, but people have to weigh the risks and benefits and really try to do everything they can to minimize those risks.
Dr. Jha, You know, in the course of this conversation, I have really appreciated your factual analysis of where we are and even the moments where you're evincing a little bit of optimism. I mean, I think it's actually given me more hope than I had before. And yet at the same time, my mind circles back to where we started, which is the curve is not bending down overall in the United States. We're bumping along at a plateau of a certain number of deaths every month. And it's a pretty high number. I mean, just can we return to that fact for a moment? I mean, is that and yet the nation is continuing its process of reopening in 50 different ways. So, like, I mean, is that acceptable to you? That it seems as if we've sort of made this bargain that a certain number of deaths is okay.
So not only is it not acceptable, it's also wholly unnecessary. If you think if my timeline of the vaccine is right, and let's say next May or June is when we have a vaccine, if we're looking at 25,000 deaths a month over the summer, we're going to cross the 200,000 mark in September. And we're probably going to cross the 300,000 deaths before the end of this year, because the number of cases will almost surely tick up in the fall, and probably 400,000 deaths by the time next spring rolls around. This is unbelievable, like that we have just decided this is okay. No other country, no other major industrialized country in the world is going to have this kind of suffering and death. And we have decided somehow it's okay when it is entirely preventable. We have – this is not fated. We can change the future. It requires smart policy, aggressive testing and tracing, things that will actually get us more comfortable getting our lives back. But it just seems like there is no interest in Washington to do this. And states are trying, but it's very hard for states to pull this off on their own. And I'm most days I wake up and I think, I can't believe we're here in the middle of the worst pandemic in history, and we're just accepting a level of suffering that is unimaginable to me.
And those numbers are, if things continue at the same rate, you also added that there's likely to be another surge.
Yeah, those numbers could easily be much worse. But they also could be much better if we decide to act, right? Like if we say, okay, we're really going to get aggressive on testing. You know, in Massachusetts, we're opening into phase two and we've got about 10,000 tests a day, and that's pretty good compared to other states. And I've been saying to our political leaders, no, like we should set our ambitions much, much higher. We should suppress this virus and let's become the example for the rest of the country that says we actually can beat this virus. America may not be New Zealand, but Massachusetts can be New Zealand. Massachusetts can be Iceland. Massachusetts can be Germany, which has mostly managed to bring the virus under control. Not perfectly, but much, much better than we have.
Yeah. I mean, look, again, full transparency, obviously, we're based here in Boston. So that's great to hear. But there are 49 other states, right? We need that everywhere.
We do need that everywhere. But here's why it's important for a few states to lead. We're not going to get leadership from the federal government. I think, you know, the testing debacle that has been just a mess. Well, guess what? The testing czar of the United States, of the White House, recently stepped down, and there's no plans to replace them. This is the federal government basically throwing in the towel and saying, I know we're only in the third inning of this baseball game, but we're walking away. We're not going to help. So it is now up to states. And what I have hoped is if a few states lead, other states will follow, because other states will see that you can actually suppress the virus, you can get the economy going again, and you don't have to deal with the level of suffering. And other states will want that and emulate that. And that's how we get through this pandemic.
Well, Dr. Ashish Jha is director of the Harvard Global Health Institute and a professor of global health at the Chan School of Public Health. And by the way, beginning in September, he's moving to Brown University to become the dean of public health there. Dr. Jha, congratulations on that, and thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me on, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.